No worries.
Stuff. I gotta bring a blanket. What else do I got?
Well, we are telling the story of Jesus, and we're looking at the book of John specifically. So if you want to turn to John chapter 9, that's where we are today. And while you're turning there, we'll tell you about something that happened to me a couple years ago. I was having to fly to San Diego on a Sunday, and my flight was scheduled to where I could go to church over at Shiloh and then leave from there, drive to the airport, and catch my plane. So go to services and stay a little bit longer than I should have. And for a lot of you who are here on Sunday mornings and the last to leave, I'm usually the last one out, so you would know that's probably par for my course. But at any rate, Judy drove me to the airport, and I had a suitcase, and I had a carry-on with a computer in it. And anyway, I get up there, and I'm kind of sweating because I know we're getting close to that plane that's supposed to take off, but I still got time to go and check in, and I do that, and I get my suitcase to put it up to be weighed, and the flight attendant or whoever it was at the counter said, "Oh, I'm sorry, we can't take that." And I said, "What do you mean? You just checked me in and gave me a boarding pass and everything." She said, "Yes, but you have to be here at least 30 minutes ahead of time to check in any luggage." And I said, "You got to be kidding me. I've got to be at a corporation in San Diego at 5 o'clock in the morning. I've got to get on the plane." And she said, "Oh, you'll get on the plane. It's just your luggage isn't." And I said, "Well, how much is it going to cost to get in on another flight?" And it was astronomical, and I checked with FedEx. Anyway, I flew to San Diego without any luggage. And I got to tell you, I have never been afraid of a plane falling in the sky or crashing or anything like that. But I was afraid boarding that flight because I thought, what am I going to do? I don't have any change of clothes. I don't have anything. And it got worse because I sat by this guy on the plane who was an engineer. This was the flight from Tyler to Dallas to catch my next flight. And I started smelling this distinct smell of BO. And it's October and it's hot. And I started getting really, really sensitive. I thought, oh man, if it's already bad now, what's it going to be like tomorrow and the next day? And what am I going to do? And I just became obsessed by this smell. And then we get aboard the shuttle. Y'all ever taken the shuttle? And Wayne, it's not that bad. You look really serious right now. This isn't as bad as it sounds, okay? I learned a lot from this experience. Don't worry. But I board the shuttle, and the guy's there too because we're going to the same spot, and then we'll change directions. But that smell is still there, and I'm just feeling very self-conscious. I think, oh, man, that guy must be – he probably can't wait to get rid of me. And so we land at the – or get off our shuttle at the terminal, and we go our separate ways. And now I'm focused on trying to get to my connection. But at some point I realized, wait a minute, that smell is no longer here. So that was a relief. It was the other guy, I guess, who left his luggage and smelled bad, but it wasn't me. But anyway, that was a very, very stressful flight to San Diego. That was a stressful night, and it was a stressful week because I had to do a complete change in my whole strategy, and I wasn't sure how I was going to handle it because I pretty much had lost everything except the clothes on my back and the computer I was taking along to do the work I was going to do. And later, I thought about that, especially with passages like John 9. And so I will ask you, what if you had to lose everything except the clothes on your back to follow Jesus? What would that life be like? How would you anticipate that life heading into it? Would you have a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety? Would you have a lot of contentment? Would you be courageous without fear? How would you feel? And all that to say, we're looking at a guy who had to face that very challenge this morning in John 9. So what I want to do is ask a series of questions. I probably got this along the way. I remember hearing Landon Saunders when I was at ACU 40 years ago talk about the blind man, these questions may very well come from him. So you've probably heard these before. There's no copyright on them. And I'm going to ask these as we look at these passages. I'm going to ask a series of questions. And the first one begins in this first section, John chapter 9, verses 1 through 12. And I want to ask, what were the disciples thinking about the blind man? So I want to read some of these verses to you. Beginning in verse 1, as he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Now, is that the most sympathetic, people-centered question to ask heading into this, not confrontation, but this meeting with this blind man? Hey, who sinned that he's this way? In other words, they weren't looking at him as a human being. They were looking at him as a religious question, as a doctrinal issue. It reminds me, in my first year in Abilene in the dorm, across the hall and a few doors down, there was a dorm room where a Bible major lived, and several of his friends would come in. It seemed like every night. It probably wasn't that often. But a lot of times the door was open, and they would go and they'd get together, and they would debate doctrinal issues and biblical questions. And you'd hear that night after night. And sometimes it'd get pretty heated, the arguments they'd have. But I don't ever recall them getting together and going to serve somebody. It was as if their whole faith was wrapped up in an analytical study of the Bible. And that was it. And I think it must have left a bad taste in my mouth, because I still remember it all these years later. And I thought about them when I looked at this passage. You don't look at people as questions to be debated. They're people. They're human beings. They're made in the image of God. Now, it is interesting to see how Jesus responded, because keep in mind, these are Jesus' best and brightest. These are his closest disciples who are looking at this human being as a question instead of a human. Verse 3, Jesus says, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. Then look at verse 5. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. I'll stop there. I don't think Jesus was saying, well, let God use people like tools and not treat them as human beings. And so watch this. This is going to be a great trick. Rather, what I think he was saying was, conceding the fact that we live in a fallen world, we no longer live in Eden, and that's our fault. It's really irrelevant why this man is in the condition of blindness that he is. What is relevant is, watch what God does. Watch how God moves in this. And then you look at verse 6, showing a little empathy here. This is one of my favorite verses. Having said this, Jesus spit on the ground, made some mud with saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. I wonder what this blind man thought. Hearing this man come up, walk up, and all of a sudden, I don't know if he did or if he did or what. What do you think this blind man did, first thing? Don't you know through the years he's had people spit on him? And he's probably thinking, incoming, here it comes again. But that's not what Jesus did. And really, there's a whole Bible class that you can go with, the background of saliva and how they viewed saliva as a life force, culturally and everything else. I'm not going to take us through that today, because I think that'll get us too much into the weeds. But look at verse 7. Jesus says, go wash in the pool of Siloam. And the man did. He went and he washed. And I'm fascinated by the fact of that Jesus sent him instead of doing something that probably you and I would have done if we were really practicing empathy that day, which would have been what? there's a pool over there. I want you to go wash. Here, let me take you. Or, Simon Peter, would you walk this guy over to the pool? Wouldn't that have been a nice thing to do? Why didn't Jesus do the nice thing here? Was he not a nice person? No, it takes me back to one of the stories we looked at earlier. Remember when Jesus talked to the guy at another pool? And his whole concern was, hey, do you really want to get well? Remember that? And we talked about how sometimes people want to stay in the condition they're in. They don't want to get well because then what are they going to do? And here, this is a little offshoot of this. Jesus wasn't interested so much in converting people as he was in making disciples. And if you watch this, his ministry, that's kind of baked into that cake. All right? He's not looking at collecting baptisms and stacking them on the wall as pelts or having a number there, number 101 baptized. No, he's interested in making disciples. And I think what's going on here is, in his wisdom as the Son of God, he decided, I'm going to do him a good deed and enough by helping him go from being blind to seeing. But he's still got a life ahead. And it's in his best interest that I let him walk to the pool and take care of that himself. Now, that's one of various reasons, I think, in his strategy here. But all of that to say, this whole book is really emphasizing the incarnation of Jesus. What's incarnation? Well, that's a fancy word meaning God in skin. So, God came into the world in skin. And as Jesus was ascending into heaven, one of his big points was God is still going to remain in this world in skin. Not my skin, but in your skin. God will live in you. So God will be present in this world in skin. And we call those people who have God living within them in their human skin the church. Right? So, the incarnation is still taking place today. God is still living in this world in skin, in your skin, and in my skin. And so what that means is we grow as disciples, and that can be challenging, and that can be difficult. And for that reason, God does not do everything for us, but he calls us to collaborate with him, God in skin. So, God doesn't do everything, nor do we. Have you ever read this proverb from Scripture? If it's to be, it's up to me. That's a trick question, because the answer is no. That's not in the Proverbs. Yet we quote it, don't we? If it's to be, it's up to me. Well, that's a fancy little proverb that we can all remember, but that's not the Christian walk either. There is some kind of collaboration, God in skin. We participate, we work hard for God, and yet we cannot do anything without God, and God is working through us. It's sort of like with my kids. I could have tied their shoes and continue to do so to this day. I decided in my brilliance that that probably wouldn't be good, and so at some point I started backing off and letting them do more and more, and a couple times they'd probably trip and things. But it's in the best interest of everybody that they tie their own shoes. And I think sometimes God does that with us. It's in his wisdom, he decides it's in the best interest of my kingdom to back off and let Mark work with this a little bit. He may struggle with it, but that's okay. Because in that struggle, he'll take on more of my character. So plant that seed here in this story as Jesus tells a blind guy, hey, there's the pool over there. You go get him, Tiger. He's not being rude. He's not being crude. He's being the Lord of this guy's life. And you're going to see the payoff later. All right. Are you with me so far? Does this make any kind of sense? Okay. Well, as we move on, we're going to see another little group. All right? Because the blind man goes and washes, and he is able to see, and there is a commotion that goes on. If you look at verse 8, some people are saying, wait a minute, isn't that the guy who used to sit around and beg, the blind guy? Well, hey, he's seeing now. If you look at verse 11, verse 10, people are demanding to know, how is it that your eyes are opened? And he replied, the man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash, so I went and washed, and then I could see. Where is this man? They asked him. I don't know, he said. Now, if we were an instrumental church, this is where we would play some scary music because it's fixing to get bad, all right? John's villains are fixing to come into the picture, and that's in verse 13. These villains today in this story are the Pharisees. And so if you look at verse 13, they brought to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. Now, the day on which Jesus had made the mud and had opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Therefore, the Pharisees also asked him how he received his sight. He put mud on my eyes, the man answered. That's a real fancy way of healing somebody, isn't it? Put mud on my eyes. And I washed, and now I see. And some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others asked, how can a sinner do such miraculous signs? So they were divided. And finally, they turned to the blind man. What do you have to say about him? It was your eyes he opened. So what are the Pharisees thinking about Jesus here? You get the idea? They're looking at him as a lawbreaker, as someone who is refusing to keep the law of God because this happened on the Sabbath. Incidentally, we talked about this before, so we're not going to go into it again, but he is not breaking the laws of the Old Testament. He is breaking some of the traditions of the in the minds of the Pharisees that they have elevated to the place of law. But he's not a lawbreaker and a sinner. Yet that's how these Pharisees see him. So they ask the blind man, who was it that made your eyes open? And he said, verse 17, he is a prophet. And then the Jews did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. Okay, so you see how desperately they want to be convinced that Jesus is not the Son of God, is not the one that healed. The guy must have been able to see all along. That's the step they've taken now. Now let's move into the third question. What were the parents thinking about the blind man? What were the parents thinking about the blind man? Now, I think this is one of those turns that's really, really sad, because what we're going to see is, you remember Jesus saying, I didn't come to make my first priority keeping families together. My first priority is people put their faith in me. And I'm paraphrasing here. If that means families divide over it, so be it. But I am the center of your universe. You remember him talking about that? All right. Think about that as background. Because watch what happens with these parents and with this son. Again, verse 18. The Jews did not believe him that he had been born blind, that he had been blind and had received his sight, until they sent for the man's parents. Is this your son? They asked. Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it that he can now see? We know he is our son, the parents answered. And we know he is born blind. But how he can see now, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself. So what were the parents saying about the blind man? Well, they're thinking, we know he was blind, and we know he can now see. But what were they thinking about Jesus? Do you see them saying, I don't think I want to get involved in this? And so they're very casually constructing their words in such a way to where they can get out of this situation. Now, why is that? Because if the Pharisees continue in this direction and decide this Jesus is a scammer, And if the blind man or anyone else insist upon continuing to follow Jesus, the Pharisees are going to expel that person from the synagogue. And this is a big deal. Expulsions from the synagogue come usually in one of three lengths of time. One of them is 1 to 10 days. One of them is 11 to 30 days. One of them is for the rest of your life. So when they're talking to the Pharisees here, and later when the blind man is, they know that's what is at stake. They're going to lose their family. If they're kicked out, they're going to lose their family. They're going to lose their support network. They're going to lose their friends. They're going to lose their church. So the stakes are very, very high. Now, would you look at verse 22? His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for already the Jews had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Christ would be put out of the synagogue. That is why the parents said, "He is of age. Ask him." So the parents looked at Jesus, I think, with appreciation, but also fear, because they really appreciated what they had, and they did not want to give it up. Now, I want you to look at what follows, beginning in verse 24. And let's see what the blind man thinks about the Pharisees. I think this is one of the richest passages of Scripture in all the New Testament. A second time, the Pharisees, summoned the man who had been blind. "Give glory to God," they said. "We know this man is a sinner." The blind man replied, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see." Then they asked him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered, "I have told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too?" I love sarcasm. Sarcasm was alive and well in the New Testament times. Isn't that a great answer? Why do you keep doing this? Are you really interested in becoming a disciple of Jesus? Hey, great. Of course, they weren't. And so if you look at verse 28, look at how they respond. Then they hurled insults at him and said, "You are this fellow's disciple, and we are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from." Then the man answered, "Now that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly man who does his will." By the way, isn't this amazing? This guy, without any kind of training, taking on these fellows who had a lot of training, is able to debate so effectively, especially when there's so much at stake. I mean, these are really, really good responses. So this guy's a pagan. How's he able to do this? "I was blind, but I can see." Come on, guys, get your logic straight. Verse 32. "Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." To this they replied, "You were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us?" And what do? They changed his life. They removed from him every anchor that he had ever had. He lost everything, including his family. So, what was the blind man thinking about the Pharisees? You guys don't get it. You should. You're supposed to, but you don't. And about Jesus. Well, we're looking at the early stages of his faith developing. But do you see that it's starting to grow? And especially as the adversity hits, he's starting to allow his faith to take him what looks like a corner that he may not be able to get out of, but he's still willing to go there for Jesus. So he's still not exactly sure about all this, but he's putting his faith in the right direction. Isn't that way faith is? Does everybody get it right from the time they come out of the baptistry? It's a process of growth, is it not? We're all children in the faith, and we hopefully grow and mature. All right, look at verse 28, as we already mentioned. They cursed him and kicked him out of the synagogue. And then I want you to look again at verse 31. We know that God doesn't listen to sinners, but he is ready to hear those who worship him and do his will. All right, that is setting up something real important. John, am I getting into too many details here? I know I've read a lot of scripture and everything. I apologize if I am, because we're doing a lot of analysis here, but I think this is really, really important. So if it's too much teaching, I apologize. But he is setting up something here, and the payoff's going to come in just a few verses. And it's one of the most important things I've ever seen. And it's also a very effective thing in terms of studying people who look at Jesus as a good man, but not as God. Notice that phrase in verse 31. He is ready to hear those who worship him and do his will. All right. I want you to look at verse 35. Jesus heard that they had thrown him out. And when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me, so I may believe in him." Now, I want to stop here. Jesus is, I think, going in for the conversion here. He wants to nail this down. When he is saying, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" what he is thinking about this blind man is, this guy is ready to become a true disciple of mine. He is ready to see me as very few people right now see me. As a matter of fact, there are very few people that Jesus make these kind of announcements to. But he picks this guy because he put his faith in the blind man. We put our faith in Jesus, but Jesus puts his faith in us. Think about the people that Jesus put his faith in. Here's a guy who seems like he has nothing to offer to expand the kingdom of God, but Jesus puts his faith in him. One of my favorites is Mark 5, the guy that we today call mentally ill. Remember the demoniac in the Gerasenes? The worst missionary candidate in the history of the world, and Jesus puts his faith in him. By the way, when he comes back later, the crowds are out to find him, because the missionary man had done his work. But that's the kind of people that Jesus is willing to put his faith in. So he's asking this very important question. Then I want you to look at what the blind man says in verse 38. "Lord, I believe." And here it is. Here's the payoff. "And he worshiped him." "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. Now, do you see in the next verse Jesus saying, stand up, for I too am a man." That's what Peter said later on in the book of Acts when somebody bowed down before him to worship him. Nope. The angels of God coming into the world in the Old Testament to interact with men. Sometimes men would worship, women would worship. Nope. Jesus accepts the worship. Why? Because we talked about last week, he's Jehovah, he's God. He is the great I am in skin. He accepts the worship. And so this blind man has a rare insight that you're not going to find often in the Gospels. Jesus is God. He worships Jesus. And these are one of the few times where Jesus is willing to reveal himself. A lot of times people are ready to call out, "Hey, this is Jesus, Son of God." And he's like, hang on. And he escapes because it's not time for him to go to the cross. But here in this private audience, he allows the man to understand, "Yes, I am God." This is a big deal. Keith and I were talking earlier, and he was asking me what I was going to preach. And I was like, kidding him. I said, I'm not sure you got any nominations. And he said, "Well, how about Revelation?" Which everybody always wants to study Revelation. And I said, no. But here is the interesting thing. In a sense, we are preaching on Revelation. You know why? Because John here anticipates one of the key teachings of the book of Revelation. Who receives worship in Revelation? The Lamb, Jesus. So John is laying the groundwork for what is to come. Is Jesus worthy of our worship? Well, what Jesus thinks about himself is, yes, I am. And we should agree with that as well. Well, Jesus is going to leave this man behind to do his work. And it's going to be, I'm assuming, effective, impactful work. I want to finish up by trying to nail down the fact that we see here in the story a guy who is willing to look at Jesus in a way that no one else was willing to do, and a guy who is willing to pay the price for that. So here's the powerful directive. Do you worship Jesus today? And if so, how? Do you? Do you worship Jesus? How? How do you worship Jesus? Well, we can worship him in song. We can worship him with our words. We can especially worship him with our actions, living our lives in service to him as worship, offering everything to him as worship. And I want to look at this guy finishing up and ask this question. What if our worship of Jesus brings us to a place to where we have to give up everything? Would that be okay? If you reached a place where you had to give up everything for Jesus but the clothes on your back, would that be okay? Would you be willing to pay that price? That story I told you earlier where I flew into San Diego, you know, thankfully that was just 1 week. And not to finish out the story that really is no longer relevant, but just to assure you, I had ways to cope. But what if someday we find ourselves in a place where worship of Jesus will cost us everything, and there's no earthly remedy? It's just Jesus or nothing. Now, I can remember 40 years ago, if I preached something like this, I'd have to try to take somebody to Liberia or somewhere and tell them about something that's happening overseas where the rights to worship God were being taken away because no one could comprehend it here. One of the nice things about the times we live in today, I think it's more and more real to us that could happen. Is it not? That could happen. So will the worship of Jesus be enough? I hope so. I hope so, because Jesus wants you. He wants to put his faith in you. He wants you to put your faith in him, and he wants us to allow him through our lives to put his faith in us. So let's be thinking about that. By the way, side note here, if I can get practical, I know some of you are studying with folks. This is one of those great verses, even in the Jehovah's Witness Bible, to take them to, because where they try to hide Jesus as God, they can't hide the fact that this man bowed down before Jesus and he accepted. Now, they may come out with another version, but take that one out. Last time I checked, it's there. And this is one of those passages that helped my friend Mauricio, Jehovah's Witness in Argentina, become a Christian, put his faith in Jesus. And now he's a minister in Argentina. So be thinking about that as well. Let's stand and let's sing.